I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hello, Sydney! Yes! Wow, look at you! I think this is the first event I have seen where I've seen this many people in a room, sans mask. I'm not even stressed. I love seeing your faces. We want to see you smile throughout this show. Before we begin proceedings, though, I do just want to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet this evening, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. Well, as I said, my name is Jan Fran. I'm so pleased to be in conversation with Judith Lucy here today at the Sydney Writers' Festival. Judith's book is... it's so genuinely funny. If you haven't picked up a copy, please do so. I know she's going to be signing copies after the show. It was just one of those books where I very rarely laugh out loud reading a book, and I laughed out loud so many times reading her book. I'm not surprised, though. Judith is someone who doesn't need an introduction. I will introduce her, though. She's been consistently funny for 35 years. Which, I don't know if you guys have seen any comedy, sometimes it's difficult to be funny for an hour. She's managed to do it for 3 decades. If you haven't seen any of her stand-up, you've probably heard some of her podcasts, or you've watched some of her shows, or you've read some of her books, including her latest one, Turns Out I'm Fine. Without further ado, please welcome to the stage, Judith Lucy.
Thanks, Jan. I will say I've been doing it for 33 years.
I'm not going to age you more than I have to, Judith. Don't you worry. Welcome. It's so good to have you here in Sydney. You happy to be here?
I am delighted to be here. I'm delighted to be out of Melbourne. I love that city, and yet it still feels a bit like a prison.
Okay, fair enough, because you wrote this book in Melbourne, during lockdown.
Isn't it great that in between getting hammered and self-pleasuring, I did this?
So I'm just checking, because a lot has happened in the last year. I don't know if you know, but are you still fine?
Yeah, although with the wisdom of hindsight, I probably should have called the book Turns Out I'm Fine... for now.
Okay.
Because it won't last, and it's not a high bar, is it? It's not like I've said, turns out I'm amazing.
It also leaves you open to a possible sequel as well.
It does. It does. Yeah. Oh, shit will keep happening, Jan. Okay. I don't doubt that for a split second. Fingers crossed for a terminal illness. And I'm 53. That's probably just around the corner.
Well, I mean, how...
Should I read a bit?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do that.
Yeah, get on up. Do you want a bit of a show, Judith? Do it.
Yeah, what the hell? But I have to tell you, it is miraculous to be out of Melbourne because you don't know what we went through, Sydney. The worst bit was during the second really long lockdown and, you know, you could see an intimate partner, but if you, like me, were a single person living alone, you couldn't see one friend. And my buddy Andrea rang me up at one point and she said, oh my God, I just want to come over and have a cup of tea. And I said, well, that's all well and good, but to keep this legal, you'll have to sit on my face. You know, which, apart from anything else, would have made drinking my Earl Grey very difficult. So you can relax. I'm at a writer's festival, but I'm still a comedian. Okay. So for those of you who haven't already bought and read the book, so no one... Yeah, it's basically about an absolutely horrendous breakup I had just before I turned the big 5-0. And that breakup somehow morphed into a complete existential crisis. So my life turned to shit. It's less shit now. That's it in a nutshell, really. So I thought I'd read you a couple of pages from the chapter that's all about my disastrous history with men. And some of you might be going, hang on a minute, wasn't her last stand-up show about her disastrous history with men? Well, the fun thing is, there's very little crossover between those stories and these ones, so colour me lucky. Oh, and for those of you who are playing at home, it's the same outfit. Oh, yes, I've made an effort, Sydney. Also lost my page.
69,
thank
funnily
you.
Enough.
Oh. All right. So, yeah, I write this before I get into the examples of my disastrous history. Actually, before we get to that, let's consider how amazing it is to be an attractive, young, straight, white male. It must really rock. The world has always been, and for the most part, continues to be your oyster. If you choose to, you can have a lot of sex. Many of the men I slept with seemed very comfortable with the idea of putting it about as much as they could. As one of them said to me, "We're allowed to have fun, aren't we?" This particular guy had a great deal of fun with me and many other women. I had fun with him too for a while, but that stopped when I realised that I was in love and he was simply really digging putting his cock in me and then getting on with his life. Not with his penis still in me. Although I'm sure guys have tried that. Sorry, baby, I thought I could mow the lawn and still be inside you. Here's your ear. Men are very good at compartmentalising when it comes to getting their rocks off. I read stories now about women who sleep with a man they've met on Tinder and spot him swiping right again while they're putting their clothes back on to leave. If that app had existed when I was in my 20s, most of the men I'll be telling you about in this chapter would have done exactly the same. One of my mistakes was assuming that if a man had sex with me, then he must be at least a little bit interested. What an idiot! In my defence, that film revolving around a young man fucking an apple pie was yet to come out yet. But even if it had been out, I probably would have thought, sure, it's a little freaky, but maybe he has deep feelings for pastry. Maybe he's doing that because one day he wants to marry a flan. The other problem, as I've already mentioned, was that I wasn't just looking for any old guy to shack up with. I wanted a real partner in crime. I once heard Indigenous writer and performer Stephen Oliver say, "I don't want to fall for someone. I want them to step up to me." For years, I naively believed that most people want to be in a relationship with a like-minded equal. So I often went after guys who seemed like risk-takers, larger-than-life characters who I thought didn't want to marry, have kids, or work in an office, men who wanted to experiment with drugs and ideas and different ways of living. I'm not saying I wanted to spend my days writing poetry, taking ayahuasca, and living in a yurt. Although actually in my 20s, that probably would have struck me as pretty appealing. But in my experience, these sorts of men never wind up with their female equivalent. They wind up, like my father, with a woman who will look after them, who will be waiting at home while they go off and have the adventures. They might not want the 9-to-5 job, but they do want the security of having someone who, after scolding them, will nurse them through their hangovers. It's almost like they delegate. So they don't have to worry about their foibles. They marry someone who'll do it for them. I didn't know that, though, when I threw myself at painters, actors, writers, and even a photographer. I thought these creative men would want nothing better than another inspired soul to live their unusual life with. But I now understand that there was only ever room for one artist, and it certainly wasn't me. There are a million reasons why the men you're about to encounter were not interested in having a relationship with yours truly. I do have very pointy elbows for a start. But at the time, I always assumed it was because there was something wrong with me. I don't think that anymore. Woo! Thank you. Who knows what other incredible revelations I had while writing the book?
So men, huh?
Yeah. What up?
What's with them?
I don't know, and I am done.
You're done?
Oh, I'm done. Look, I've done a couple of these, Jan, and each time a woman in the audience, sometimes a younger woman, sometimes an older woman, has stood up at the end and gone, "Judith, I've had a lot of bad luck with men. What should I do?" And I turn to them and say, "Give up." I say, honestly, just concentrate on making your life amazing, and if they come along, they come along.
Yeah.
But I've bought myself a tremendous vibrator, It's called The Womanizer. Get on board if you've got the appropriate genitals, because it really has turned things around for me, I can honestly say. Actually, on the package, it says that it has a yoga neck. So I guess that's just a fun way to say to my G-spot, hey, namaste.
I guess this book is partly figuring out, you know, not so much what's up with men, but rather, you know, what is with you and men? What's this relation that's happening, or rather not happening? Have you worked it out? Are you any closer to finding the answer to that question?
Well, I've given up, Jan.
Okay,
so
that's
in many respects, I have figured it out. So yeah, the book is actually written in thirds. So the first third is eloquently called "How the Fuck Did I Get Here," and that's where I do look back on my childhood and school and my 20s and 30s and my disastrous relationships with men, just the whole history of it. And then the second part of the book is called "Having the Rug Pulled Out from Under Me," and that's where I go into the relationship breakdown and a midlife crisis and menopause and talk about my brother's death. And then the last third of the book is really uplifting, and that's called "Trying," and that's about me trying to, you know, get my life back on track. But I suppose that when I looked back, the biggest revelation I had writing the book was actually acknowledging my own misogyny. That was the thing that really kind of floored me. And it was like going back, I mean, the chapter that's about my, because I'm adopted, so I write about my two mums, Jan and Anne. So Jan was my birth mum and she relinquished me, and Anne Lucy brought me up. And going right back to that part of my life and looking at just the lack of respect we had for my mum, Anne. You know, Dad ran the house. Dad was like a kind of less attractive Don Draper who just, you know, but just lived that life, you know, drank, smoked, screwed his secretaries, the whole lot. And Mum was, of course, just this ubiquitous presence who did everything for us and did all the boring stuff and had to do all the discipline stuff. And Dad just seemed like this incredible glamorous figure who would sail in, drink, looked like he was having a lot more fun than Mum. And so we all just kind of followed his lead. And I look back at the way both my brother and I treated our mum and just thought, wow, we didn't have a lot of respect for her because my father didn't. And just sort of realising how much of that I'd internalised. And then, you know, like so many of us, tried to date my father for a while, not literally, obviously, but, you know, so I kept throwing myself at kind of charming, womanizing alcoholics, which really panned out well.
Were you just picking the wrong men? Is that partly what was going on?
I think there are many things that were going on.
Yeah.
And I think also not very many men want to be with successful women.
Why do you think that is?
I'm just putting that out there.
Why do you reckon that is?
Because I think we live in a patriarchy, Jan. Everyone write that down.
What? We live in a patriarchy?
I know, right? I mean, you thought you'd get some laughs, but did you think you'd hear a bombshell like that? I've really done some thinking. I have gone deep. And so because of that, and I obviously, I mean, I think we would all acknowledge too that the patriarchy is fucked for men, just like it is for women.
Yeah.
But I think so many men, consciously or unconsciously, believe that it's their job to be the breadwinner, the main breadwinner, the person who's kind of still the head of the household.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of men do still wrestle with that. And I think a lot of men don't like being with funny women either, to be honest with you. I once had a conversation, I've written about this in the book, with Alan Davies, the British comedian's a really old buddy of mine, and I asked him about it once because I'm not an exception to the rule. I think if you talk to a lot of female stand-ups, you'll be struck by the lack of luck we've had in the area of our love lives.
Mm.
And I asked him about that one day, and he said, look, I suspect that in most relationships, there's a performer and an audience member. And he was talking about all relationships, not ones where there was actually a performer. And he said, and I think in healthy relationships, you take it in turns, you know, at being the person who needs the attention and the person who does maybe the listening. listening and the caring. And he said, but I suspect that for a lot of men, they don't ever want to be the audience.
Right.
They always want to be the performer. So I'm screwed.
Right. Or maybe this is a blessing. Maybe you're actually not screwed. Oh, maybe
well,
this is
no,
a blessing.
Because it turns out I'm fine.
Hey! Because in the book, after, you know, detailing many kind of disastrous relationships, you do meet someone who you refer to as the one.
Yes.
And in the book, he's called Mr. Rabbit, so we don't actually know who he is. But tell us a little bit about Mr. Rabbit, because he's pretty central.
He is pretty central. I call him Mr. Rabbit because he and I used to have a podcast together called Mr. Rabbit and the Bearded Lady. And in that podcast, we used to review movies because, like some crazy 80s rom-com, we met because he worked in my local video store. And it was perfect. I would go in there, we'd chat about movies, he'd give me recommendations, but I actually never thought we'd wind up together. It literally didn't cross my mind because he was 12 years younger
than
me.
You were renting.
Hang on, sorry, he still is. I just like talking about him as though he's dead. Sorry, Jan. Not really.
I just need to clarify as to whether you were still actually renting videos in the year 2013.
I was. DVDs.
Okay, right, that's
DVDs. Right. Good God, Jan.
Just like,
I know you're 36 stores. And I'm a menopausal 53-year-old, but hang on a minute. No, right, but yeah. It was like kind of, there weren't that many video stores left by that stage.
Okay, so it was bespoke boutique videos. Well, that's not the point. I'm.
No, and I think this is what we should really be focusing on. But
I'm sorry, where was this?
It was in Balaclava. No, it was actually one of the last kind of really great video stores around. And so they had a big art house and nostalgia sections, and everyone who worked there was male and everyone was a nerd. You know, they were all like little Quentin Tarantinos. And he was particularly nerdy. I used to love talking to him about movies. And yeah, long story short, I was the last customer he served before he went overseas for his big finding himself trip. And he told me that he was finishing early because he wanted to end by serving one of his favourite customers. And that gave me a little buzz. And then he went overseas. I actually moved from Melbourne to Sydney for a couple of years. I never expected to see him again. I moved back to Melbourne, back to the same suburb, walked into the old video store. He's behind the counter. I said, what are you doing here? He said, I'm moving. I've just come by to collect some boxes. We had an excruciating conversation because I'm standing there thinking, I mean, there's nothing going on, but I really like this guy. I'd like to have a drink with him. But anyway, chickened out of it, walked away, was a bit disappointed with myself and said, if I ever bump into him again, I'm going to ask him out for a drink. Next day, walking along the street, yeah, bump into him. What are you doing? I'm returning the boxes. Okay. And that was that, really. And look, we had a few false starts because I kept thinking, well, this is a fling. You know, I'm not...
Why did you think that?
Because I'd never gone out with someone who was 12 years younger than me. And look, in my defence, when I tell you that I was on at least two occasions mistaken for his mother, you will understand my reticence.
Okay.
And once was actually in our local bottle shop, which we may have frequented quite a bit. And I went in there and I just missed him apparently. So I walked in and the young woman behind the counter said, oh, I think I just saw your son. And Jan, Sydney, I think you'll be very proud of me. I think I handled it extremely well. I simply turned to her and I said, you know, I love that kid. But between you and me, he's a lousy fuck. So yes, Jan, for a long time I thought, I'm just having a little affair with a great nerdy film guy. But then, and do you know what? One of the turning points was when he came around one night and he said, I know you don't like sweets, so I didn't want to buy you chocolates, so instead I bought you some really fancy butter. And I thought, here's a man who understands my love of fat and salt. Marry me. So yeah, then we... I don't know, I guess about 2 or 3 years in. I mean, I actually literally gave him a card that said, you're my forever. And meant it. Not even any irony. So we were, in fact, just... despite the fact that he was at my place six nights a week, often seven. He held on to his little studio apartment.
Yeah.
And we had finally decided that he was going to move in with me and we were going to start saving to buy somewhere together. And I was off touring with my very good friend, the wonderful Denise Scott. We were in Brisbane doing the last weekend of shows in 2017 of our show Disappointments. And then the shit really hit the fan, Jan.
Yeah, okay.
Shall I just continue?
I reckon you should just continue. Tell us about that.
Well, I was actually about to pop off and do an interview for the ABC. I think Scotty was even waiting for me in the foyer when the accountant from Jan and I were with the same agency. So, the accountant from that agency, Token Artist, rang me up and said, because, oh, look, I have a ridiculous job, obviously, and most of my money comes from touring, so I tend to get paid in lump sums. And they basically put half in an account that I live off and half in an account that I never look at because it's for the tax department. You know, why torture yourself looking at money you can't spend? So the only people who have access to that are me and my accountant. So he rang me up and he said, I've gone to pay your tax. There's not enough money in the account. And I said, well, that can't be. And he said, well, you have been making all those withdrawals. And I said, no, I haven't. And then I put the phone down, I rang up the bank, and immediately they were able to say, well, it's going into Mr. Rabbit's account, but I'm still in complete denial. So I spent the next 24 hours convinced that there was a scam, that the bank had made a mistake. And I remember I went down, saw Scotty, we did the interview, I told her what was going on, and then I said, and she had spent a lot of time with Mr. Rabbit, by the way, so she knew him pretty well. And I said, this has happened. What do you think it is? And she turned to me and she said, I think he's fucked you over. And she only said to me quite recently that when she said that to me, I looked like I was just going to slap her across the face. I still didn't believe it, though, and it was 24 hours later when I rang him again to say, I'm so sorry because I think it looks like I'm accusing you of something and I know you would never do this to me. And then he said the sentence that I will never, ever forget. I can't keep gaslighting you. I've been stealing money from you for over 2 years. Yeah, right?
Can I ask you about that moment?
Yeah.
What was that moment like for you actually hearing that coming from him?
It's like any really horrendous thing that happens. It's like an out-of-body experience, and it's like you're seeing it all happen in slow motion and going, this can't possibly be real. And I honestly think I was actually in shock for months.
Were you face to face or was this a...
No, this was on the phone.
Oh, this was on the phone. So were you home on your own? Were you in a hotel?
So I was in a hotel room and then I had to go off and do two shows that night with Scotty. And I don't know if any of you saw Disappointments, but like the turning point of the show is a big argument that Scotty and I have. And we came up with this technique many years ago with the late, great Linda Gibson. The three of us used to do shows together. And look, there'd always be a fight in there. But we would write our own insults because that meant that the insults were much nastier. Because, you know, you wouldn't write. I wouldn't actually write something nasty about Scotty. So, yeah. So I had to do those two shows and listen to her say things to me like, well, we all know the only reason he goes out with you is because you pay for everything. And I had written all these jokes about being a mother and, you know, being mistaken for his mother and him basically living off me. And, yeah, so... To hear that, well, let's just say the context was a little different.
Yeah, I suppose it lived up to the name of the show, Disappointments.
Scotty and I used to laugh that show just kept writing itself. And it really did. So, yeah, two shows and then one more show on the Sunday. And unsurprisingly, I got very drunk. And then went home on the Monday, and that's when we had just an excruciating conversation, which was really just like a longer version of the one we'd had on the phone, where there didn't really seem to be much of a reason in... like a lot of people have said to me, was he gambling? It was nothing like that. Look, he has absolutely suffered from depression, and he does have some mental health issues. I knew that. He obviously knew that, but they were a lot more... pronounced than I had realised. Mm. But really, he seemed to think that, because of course I had already lent him money and given him money and paid for heaps of stuff, and he seemed to think it had reached the point where if he asked me for another cent, I was just going to end the relationship, which is crazy and would never have happened. But, you know, we come back to the patriarchy, Jan, because I think he really thought, he had this kind of crazy idea about being a perfect boyfriend. And I think in his head that meant that, again, he had to be the breadwinner,
yeah,
or at least
provider.
Felt like he could keep up with me. And in his head, the only way he could do that was stealing from me. And yet, the real irony is that that's the one thing that actually our relationship couldn't recover from. Like,
yeah.
I think if I'd even found out he was having an affair, I could have gotten over it, but I couldn't get over that.
Where are you at now with your relationship? Has he paid back the money?
Do you know what? He has paid back a little bit. And I don't really care. I mean, obviously, I'd like to get the money back because it was tens and thousands of dollars. But
I'd be getting that money back.
Look, if I'm really honest with you, he paid it back for ages and it might recently just have stopped.
Okay.
But I'm just leaving that for now. We've seen each other a few times. We actually... I miss this person enormously. Someone put it really well to me the other day. It was a really good friend of mine who was married for 17 years, because he really did the dirty on her, but she was so beautiful to him for such a long time after their relationship ended. And she said to me, well, Jude, it's because love isn't a coat. I couldn't just slip it off. And I think that's how I felt for a long time with him, you know, and I really wanted him to be in my life. I thought we could be friends, but it's not looking like that's going to be the case. Mm. And, you know, the part of that was also because I'm still really worried about him. I mean, the ridiculous thing is I still feel responsible for him. I mean, he's in his 40s now, so, yeah. Grow up!
Why do you decide to write a book about it?
Because I don't have a creative bone in my body, Jan. And the only reason I have a career is because I've exploited my private life for cash.
Hey.
And look, the good news is that if that's your jam, listening to me do that, there's no end in sight. That's all I've got.
Did you tell him you were writing about him, though?
What is kind of amazing about him, because I had mentioned him in routines and stuff before, and I almost always, I even did it with my parents, run things by people before I talk about them. And he was like, you don't have to. I know what you do for a living. I know who you are as a person. I'm not remotely worried about anything you'll ever say about me. He absolutely knew I did a show because Judith Lucy versus Men, that was the starting point for that show. So he knew about that. I also, look, I mean, of course a relationship breakup was a bit of a letdown, but let's face it, I have gotten a show, a podcast series and a book out of it. So, you know, every cloud. So he certainly knew about the podcast series. And the last time we saw each other, I did say, I am writing this book. So he knew it was coming.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk a little bit about getting older. And firstly, I kind of just want to say I hate the idea that, you know, we're somehow supposed to stave off getting older. Like, it's literally just life.
Yeah.
And everyone's going to do it because that's
absolutely
what we're here to do.
I know, it's this idea now that aging is somehow a disease we have to fight.
Yeah, this blows my mind,
yeah,
personally. But the reason I'm bringing it up is because when all of this was going down, obviously very intense, you were approaching 50. That's a milestone. You're also going through menopause. That's a thing. So tell us about that time, about walking headfirst into aging.
Look, I really was just walking on sunshine, Jan. Everything was coming up Lucy. So the reality is that my life had kind of started to go to shit a few years before I met Mr. Rabbit, when my brother died of lung cancer, and he was the last remaining member of our immediate family, and we were very close, so that was obviously horrendous. I was with Mr. Rabbit at that point, and I think my body kind of went into shock because I became menopausal like that, like literally overnight. There was no weird peri-peri, you know, I wasn't getting any of that. The only peri-peri I was getting was when I went to Nando's. So I just didn't even know what was happening for a while, and I thought, oh, this is probably just stress and grief. And anyway, no, turned out it was menopause. So, you know, I finally went to a doctor and did all of that. And so that was going on. I mean, the worst thing ever was my brother dying, obviously. Menopause was going on. I also felt, and it was because I was working a lot with Scotty too, we tell each other everything. So I was so aware of all the offers she was getting, and I sort of felt like I wasn't getting any. So I also had this sneaky suspicion that my career was going to shit. And of course, there was absolutely no way to ignore the fact that the world seemed to be going a bit to shit. So the reality was that, in fact, the only thing I felt good about was my relationship. I really thought all this other stuff will be fine because I have met my prince. So when that relationship ended, it was just like, oh God, everything I had basically been sweeping under the carpet just sort of was right there waiting for me. And of course, there's a very big difference, as I'm sure some people in the audience will know, between my last big relationship, right? You know, I was, that happened just before I turned 40. But there's a big difference between being single and 39 and being single and 49 and suddenly going, hang on a minute, what if I'm now single forever? And all of that is tied up with menopause and, of course, you know, feeling like you're losing your desirability. Because, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot in the book about dry vaginas.
Yes, yes. Hello, lube. Because, of course, the thing is, once again, because of the society we live in, we are essentially told that women are here to look good and have babies. So once you hit the old dry vagina, you start to wonder if you're ever going to be seen as useful or desirable again. I was actually surprised by how much it affected me. I, you know, as a feminist and someone who, you know, is a great believer in the title of Judge Judy's book, Beauty Fades, Dumb as Forever. Not as good as her other title, Don't Pee on My Leg and Tell Me It's Raining. But yeah, I just didn't think that any of that stuff would bother me quite as much as it did. But I mean, so you have the real knock to your confidence, I think. And then on top of that, you are just dealing with symptoms that some of us make you feel like you're just hanging on by a thread.
Yeah, and you tried a bunch of stuff as well to kind of regulate the body and to, you know, to feel good about yourself, not just physically but mentally and emotionally as well. And that was a journey. There were some interesting bits and pieces there.
Look, I basically, again, when I am going through some shit, how can I make some money out of this? Oh, I know. I'll do a podcast for the ABC. So if anyone listened to that, you'll know that I tried everything from going on a tantric tango and Tao lesson. That was interesting. I went swimming with the icebergers at 7 a.m. in the morning. Can't swim. Something else I talk about in the podcast series, but actually, so some of the stuff in the podcast series I just did for that, but a lot of it I would have done or had done anyway. And another one of those was, of course, getting my my vulva portrait done. Yeah. You know the wall of vulvas at Mona?
They do now.
Well, mine's there. And they don't actually put your name under the portrait, so there's a fun game you can play next time you're there. Although I do have it on pretty good authority that I'm Judith 155, so fellas, you're welcome. Want to have a little preview? Just get yourself over to Hobart. But that was one of the, I mean, I did wind up, you know, using that in a show, of course, because that's how much I give to my audience. Check out my enormous vulva portrait. But I did also get it done because I wanted to feel better about myself physically, and I wanted to feel better about my sexuality. And of course, Greg Taylor is the lovely artist's name. That did involve a man, but not in quite the way that, you know, in a very different way.
Yeah.
And in a way that felt like I was kind of in charge. I also, I don't know if any of you remember, many, many years ago, I slept with a male escort and I did a routine about that. And I revisited that. I thought, well, maybe that would be something to try again in my 50s. Just couldn't do it, which was interesting. I went on an introduction date. I don't... Look, I'm telling you a lot here. I don't know if you know about this. But you can go on these introduction dates where you go and have a drink with someone, and then if you like them, you go and have sex with them. And so that's what I did with a man called Adam. He assured me that was not his real name. And I thought, you're a dick, Adam. So I didn't have sex with Adam. And basically what happened, in fact, was we met for an hour. He didn't ask me a single question. I paid the $50 and bought all the drinks. And so, of course, I met a friend straight afterwards who just said, so it was like all of your other dates. So, yeah. So I wound up going with the vulva portrait instead. Okay. That was more fulfilling.
Good. And where are you at now? I mean, coming through the other side of this, what does being fine mean to you?
Being fine, and look, I have to say that I unsurprisingly get asked a lot if what I do is cathartic. And doing stand-up comedy is not cathartic.
Okay.
Because if you haven't worked shit out before you get up on stage, you people sniff it out. You're like wolves. But I actually do find writing books incredibly cathartic. I mean, not in a good way, because you are just stuck in your own head with your own shit for, you know,
you just cry typing?
Case,
just crying
I'm not typing? I'm not a cry typer.
Okay.
I'm a drink typer.
Okay.
But sort of the process of writing the book, and I think especially because we were in lockdown, I mean, it did feel a bit like I was on, you know, doing therapy on some sort of speed. It was a real revelation to me to really kind of drill down on how I'd conducted myself with men. It was really something to own my own misogyny. And it was also something to really look at, I have so defined myself by my work and my career, like without question. And I am so grateful to it and I love what I do. But it also made me realize when both of my shoulders went on me towards the end of typing the book, like I've just had an operation on this one. And I thought, something's got to give here. Like, I kind of realised that I'd been living at a level of stress and work that was not good for me.
Yeah.
Or for, well, you know, my body finally had to go, hang on a minute, we're not even going to type anymore. So, turns out I'm fine. What that looks like now is actually me having a big fat old break and trying to work out what fine now looks like for me. I mean, when you read the book, you'll see how I wound up doing a lot of volunteering and getting involved in the
gardens
and the Protect Ningaloo campaign in Western Australia. I went snorkeling with Tim Winton and hung out with a whale shark, and all of that was amazing. And it has just made me realise that I need to, oh, it's such a fucking cliche, but I really need to get the old work-life balance happening.
Yeah.
And so for the first time in 33 years, I said to Token, I am having long service leave.
Yay!
So, yeah, I'm having a few months off and I'm trying to work out what's next, but I actually feel really good about that. And I mean, I know I write this in the book, but I've reached a point where I think I've worked some stuff out enough to actually think, no, fuck it, my life is still full of possibilities and I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's where I'm at.
Yeah, that's really great. Yeah, that's, oh, yes.
You know what? That could be pity, but I'll take it.
My last question to you, I guess, was if you could go back, and particularly in light of your relationship, is there anything that you would have done differently?
Oh, I think I would have been a member of a different video store.
Just download online. Don't go into those video
stores.
Right.
You're right. That ship sailed. But yeah.
All right. Well, we've got a question here all the way from the Huon Valley in Tasmania for you, Judith. The question is...
Is it about my vulva portrait?
Perhaps it is, yeah. Number 115, did you say?
155.
155. No, the question is that science says single heterosexual women are far healthier than married attached heterosexual women.
I have heard this.
But heterosexual men are the opposite, apparently. So do you think women are trained by the patriarchy to want marriage just for men's sake?
No.
All right, well, that answers that.
No, I don't. But I think it does make sense that sometimes when men and women wind up in those relationships, because of the patriarchy, I feel like women often wind up, you know, we all know the old phrase, emotional labour, doing a lot of the heavy lifting. So I think it makes total sense to me that often, you know, men get all the nurturing and the looking after that they need in a relationship, and sometimes the woman just doesn't.
Mm.
I don't think anyone goes in wanting that to happen either, but I think, unfortunately, it often does.
Yeah. This is something that I kind of like to ask people, because I find it's a bit of an insight into sort of how they live their life. But is there... is there a mantra that you live by? Is there a saying that just that has really resonated with you that keeps popping into your head when you need it?
No.
Okay. No, there's not an Instagram inspirational quote that's really attached itself to you?
No, nothing
like that?
Oh, actually, magic happens.
I know that you have talked about some of the lessons that have come out from this, and one of them is sort of being a little bit more introspective and looking at, you know, your misogyny and how you might have played into that system. What are you going to do differently now that you've learnt this lesson, perhaps, or been a bit more introspective? Are you going to behave differently, do anything differently?
I plan on going out with less fuckwits. But, I mean, like, I do use the example in there, because, there's a chapter in there on comedy as well, where I don't ever feel that I've compromised my material. We've got a question from an actual person. Not that you're not a person, Jan,
no,
but you know
God.
What I mean. But I'm sure you all know that comedians do corporate gigs, and they're generally for, you know, a bunch of middle-aged male accountants in South Australia. And weirdly, I'm often not their first choice. And I know that in the past I have compromised myself in those situations. Almost to put, look, here's an actual thing that happened to me. But many years ago, I was reviewed in Edinburgh, and the reviewer described me as looking like Michelle Pfeiffer's younger sister. Yes, happy with that part of the sentence. But the rest of it was if a tree had fallen on top of her. Now, I know. True story. I always used to tell that joke at these corporate gigs, like right off the bat, and I absolutely knew I was telling it to put the guys at ease. It was really like me going, I know this is a bit weird, I'm a woman, I've got the microphone, I'm in the position of power, but don't worry, I'm a bit ugly and weird, so don't be scared. Seriously. And so that's the sort of stuff I just look at now and go, why was I doing that? So yeah, I think I am more aware of all of that, and I think it will alter my behaviour.
Yeah. Got a question?
Hello.
Hi. I've read your books, not the most recent one.
Well, get out.
I will. I'll borrow it from the library.
Thank you.
Oh,
yep,
great.
Great.
Lucky I can just live off the fee I'm getting from the Sydney Writers Festival.
No. Read your books, listen to podcasts.
Thank you. What's your name?
Carol.
Well, lovely
Carol
to meet
from
you,
Cronulla.
I didn't need more information, Carol, but thank you.
Listen to you on radio, watch you on TV, and...
Are you stalking me?
No. I'm only one of many. I suspect a few might share my views. Do you realise how much you... are loved and appreciated and brought so much joy to my life.
Oh, Carol! Carol. Come on, Carol.
Thank you.
Well, that's just... Can I go?
Yeah, no, I think we're done.
It's not going to get better than that.
We're done, yeah.
Thanks, Carol.
I mean, how do you know? Do you know that? That was a question. Do you know how loved you are?
I guess not. But I know now.
But when you see a sold-out show like this, you've had a career for, you know, 33 years. And there have been people who have been there from the beginning. They've been there from the beginning of your journey as a comedian.
Oh, people are idiots, Jan.
Well, but they're idiots who clearly love you.
Look.
And how does that resonate with you?
It actually, you know, God, I swore I wouldn't say the word privileged. But it's a privilege. It's a privilege. But it is kind of, look, it is kind of amazing to me that, let's face it, without, I mean, I'm really getting a bit... But without you, I wouldn't have a career. I mean, it really is that simple. And some people have been coming and seeing me for a very long time. And to feel that we are in a relationship together means more to me than I can tell you. And actually, one of the things I love about writing books is that I get to do signings and I get to meet you. And it's, you know, and so often, I guess, because I've, let's face it, overshared, people often feel that they can tell me their stories. And that's, honestly, I love it. I shouldn't say that before a book signing, but I do actually love it. And this, I'll never forget this either. This was a little story. Some of you might know that many years ago, I used to do a regular spot on Martin Malloy, Tony Martin and Mick Malloy's radio program. And I'll never forget, and look, it was at a point in my life too where I was hanging on by a thread, I think, and drinking a lot, which admittedly was giving me a lot of material. But anyway, Tony said, "Jude, I've got to tell you, we're getting a lot of letters about you and they're all saying exactly the same thing. Is she all right?" So the fact that people give a shit means a lot to me.
Yeah. I mean, just on that, because you've been doing, you know, you've been doing comedy for so long, and from the book, I glean that you have, you know, it's a fraught relationship. You love it, but it does take its toll on you. Do you see yourself doing comedy forever? Is this just part of who you are?
Annoyingly, yes. I think it probably is. I mean, I love doing this. It's the stuff that's around it that can sometimes just... look, there's a lot of anxiety. Obviously, it's not the most relaxing thing to do. You do a lot of touring on your own. I mean, I would like to get to a point, and I'm kind of at that point now, where I only really do like a big tour if I've got something to say and I really feel like doing it. But, you know, I'm so grateful because without stand-up, I wouldn't have been able to write books, I wouldn't have gotten to do podcasts and television, other things. So it's been tremendous for me. But yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to be doing cruise ships when I'm 85.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, I think that's fair.
You're still happy to do them at 50, though, just to
50,
be clear.
I'm yet to do a cruise ship, but I'm sure that's right around the corner.
Okay.
Actually, could I tell you a quick comedy cruise ship story?
Go for it, yeah, absolutely.
Because Scotty did one, and she said it was a real... It was some sort of cut price one that was like $99. Most people didn't even know there was comedy. Most people just went, it's a $99 cruise, I'm going to get blind. And she actually was talking to one of the crew who said that a guy had wandered up to him earlier in the night and gone, "Mate, we were told there was going to be whale watching on this cruise and I haven't seen any whales." And so the lovely crew guy's gone, "There's not a lot I can do about that, sir. Can't do a lot about the whales, but hopefully tomorrow." And this guy's gone, "No, you don't get it. I've paid the money and I want to see some whales." So this guy, and God, I'd marry him if I knew him, apparently said, "I completely understand, sir. Let me just get in touch with the whales now." And has apparently picked up the phone, given it a bit of... "I'm terribly sorry, sir. They've said they're really going to do their best tomorrow." And of course, the great thing is the guy went, "All right then."
Right.
Yeah.
Cruise ships. Dare to dream, Jude.
Ooh.
Oh, we've got one more question. Yes.
Hello.
Hello. My name is Josephine.
Hi, Josephine.
And I'm an out... No, just kidding. But I was going to say, my family, I'm one of four sisters. We have watched you since your days on the ABC at the very beginning of your career when you were doing...
The Late Show.
Yes, The Late Show.
Thank you.
You were always our absolute favourite.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm wondering, as someone who's done a career for this long, you would have had your fair share of people come up to you and say, you're amazing, you're wonderful, you're this, you're that. Do you do that thing?
Not enough. But sorry, do I?
Do you do that thing where people give you a compliment and tell you you're great at something and it just doesn't connect in your brain? That's someone else that's happening to?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, I think as humans, we kind of know now that, you know, our brains are like Teflon when it comes to compliments and like Velcro when it comes to criticism. And, you know, and that we're hardwired to be like that. So, yeah, there is still, you know, and God, every performer or artist will tell you the same thing, sports person. I can still tell you my bad reviews word for word, but yep, simply awful. People thought that critic didn't like the show, but I think you just got to read between the lines. But yeah, but could I tell you any of the great reviews I've received? No. So yeah, it's having said that, it is something that I think women are particularly bad at too. And I think in later life, I have gotten a lot better at least saying thank you instead of just immediately going, oh no, I'm terrible. So yeah.
The reason I was asking is because, like our previous speaker, I think you mean so much to everyone. Here.
Oh my goodness.
And I don't need a hug, I'm good.
I'm going to make love to each and every one of you. Come to the signing.
But you genuinely have, you know, have a real connection with people. And in case you don't know that, you do now. So,
well,
and I want that to stay.
I'm going to have to hug you as
oh,
well.
Oh, no.
I'm not even bothering with the stairs. Thank you. That's such a beautiful thing
true.
To say.
It's true.
Thank
absolutely
you.
Absolutely true.
Thank you.
We've got about 60 seconds.
No,
does anyone
questions.
Else want a personal hug?
Or does
from
anyone
Judith?
Just want a hug? Yes. COVID be damned.
Anyone? Well, you know what? I'll get a hug because this is it. That's the session over. We've run out of time.
Well, thank you,
Judith. You've been amazing. Thank you. You really have. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.